Okay, today is now the 23rd of September. How time flies. And I'm going to be talking about classification. Particularly, I'm going to give an overview of classification to distinguish classification from categorization, which we talked about so far. And I will then talk a lot about faceted classification, which is a particular style of classification which is emerging as a new technique in a lot of web information management, information resources. There's a nice quote about that in the paper by Denton. He says, "Librarians think this is a good idea, but are unsure of how to do it, while the web people who are already doing it are unaware of what it's called." And there's decades of history behind this idea of faceted classification, as you'll see in some of the work from Raghunathan and the Library of Congress. So what exactly is classification? Again, classification is a wonderful quote from a paper we did not read by Louis Grunberg that says, "Classification is a higher order thinking skill that requires the fusion of the naturalist eye for relationships." That means people who are good observers with a logician's desire for structured order, that is, people who want to create elegant models, the mathematician's compulsion to achieve consistent, predictable results, I might call that engineering rather than mathematics, but we know what she means, and the linguist's interest in explicit and tacit expression of meaning. So choosing words carefully. So you want to be a good observer who creates elegant models that work, that have carefully chosen words whose meaning is clear. That's the essence of classification. And I think the point that we want to remember here is that it requires lots of different perspectives and goals and skills to come together in this complex thing we call classification. Now, what exactly is classification? And in particular, how do we distinguish it from categorization? It's an important thing. Categories, as we've talked about a few weeks ago, are equivalence classes. They're sets of things, abstract or physical, processes, events, bibliographic entities that we treat the same. A classification is a system of categories that has been ordered according to some predetermined set of principles so that we can use it to organize a set of instances or entities. That's a critical point, that classification is principled. We can look at a system of categories and say, what are the underlying principles that we're following here as we classify items in the system of categories? But that doesn't mean that the principles are necessarily good or fair or robust or unbiased or anything which sounds like a good thing. Okay? But they're there. Somebody decided how they were going to do this, and that's why it's a system of classification. So classification is the verb that says assigning things to these categories. Why do we need classification systems? We need them because they give us a roadmap, a semantic roadmap, or a reference model that explain how we should understand some set of domains and the relationships among them, to understand the underlying concepts and relationships in some domain. Classifications make it easy for us to learn and communicate because they require abstract thinking to use. It's a mental exercise, okay? I mean, the essence of categorization is to create... Sorry, the essence of classification is to put things that go together in some system of categories. And so that's pretty easy when the things that go together are constrained by physical properties. But information isn't constrained by physical properties. So we have an arbitrary number of ways in which we can organize things, which is why we get things like women, fire, and dangerous things in the language, because there are no constraints that make things go together in a particular way. So we might as well have that one because it makes sense to this particular Durbal tribe of the Aborigines. But more importantly, They're not just interesting and intellectual, they actually help us do useful stuff. And that's essential, that things like a classification of diseases. You know, we need a classification of diseases to diagnose diseases, to develop medical treatments, to get our insurance company to account and pay for things, to develop techniques and skills to teach people to treat those diseases and so on. So that's an important point, that we do useful stuff with classifications, but more importantly, I hope I suggested with that example that often a classification system will be applied in ways that might have been unanticipated, which can have unintended consequences. When we sat down, and when we the rhetorical we, not me, but when we decided to get together and decide on some system of medical diagnosis, classification system for diseases or symptoms, we weren't doing it for the benefit of insurance companies. We were doing it for the benefit of physicians, people who treated diseases and disease symptoms. But when insurance companies start using those systems of classifications, of disease or assessments, to determine eligibility for reimbursement or the extent of reimbursement, what will happen? What will happen? Anybody? What will happen? Kate, do you have an opinion about this? Right, we'll have unintended consequences, and give me an example of one.
I hear things about people having tests so that they figure out what's going wrong and insurance companies.
Okay, you there's a really good example. Didn't any of you see this movie called Burn After Reading?
Yes.
Burn After, last year it came out. What was the plot of Burn After Reading? Do you remember?
Remember.
I'll tell you what it was about, because I saw it twice. I thought it was such a funny movie. A woman who works in a workout club decides that she needs plastic surgery because she has to look good, or she wouldn't be a good employee of the workout club. It would look like they weren't successful, so she has to look better, right? So she decides that plastic surgery is job-related, and she has the plastic surgery, and she goes to the insurance company and said, "You must be kidding. This isn't a job-related requirement to have plastic surgery." So she does a lot of bad things and people die and stuff. But it's motivated by her desire to force her need for plastic surgery, which is a psychological need, into the categories that were going to get reimbursed by the insurance company. I recommend that as a 202 exercise for you during, you know, some slow period of your life. Go to the Netflix and get that movie and think 202 thoughts. Okay. All right. And finally, classification systems are very useful because we embed them in our information retrieval systems and user interfaces for information retrieval, because we use things like menus or facets or hierarchies to help us display the results we get or display the way in which we're going to request things of the collection. Now, I said classification was principled. What kind of principles? What do you mean by principles? Well, principles means lawful, systematic, and arbitrary. It's a very important collection of words, because lawful means that, yeah, we have these principles and we will follow them as we define the structure of the categories of relationships. Systematic means we require that we follow those principles when we apply the system to instances, and arbitrary because we choose in developing those principles to establish categories in a way which intentionally includes other perspectives. So there is no one true way about how things go together, but when we decide what the way is, other ways are not allowed. So in some sense we're creating winners and losers, good and bad, right and wrong ways of thinking about things when we develop a classification system. Now, again, make a point. Principle doesn't always mean good. One of my favorite cartoons is Rhymes with Orange, one of my college classmates. And here you see two women talking about She's done with her husband giving advice on how to organize flowers because he said you should sort them alphabetically. And that's probably not a good arrangement of flowers. It's principled, no question about it. It's just not very good. So, how might we use principles in classification? What kind of principles might we have? We could say, well, how broad a scope should our classification system be? Should we say, classify everything that we might ever see in the world to the end of time? Or the set of things we have in front of us right now? That's called the concept of literary warrant. How much do I need to scope my classification system? Do I classify things once and for all? Or am I allowed to change the classification over time if new instances emerge? Or if I learn something? Okay? We could say that once a number or notation is assigned to some category, it never changes and never can be assigned to anything else. Is that a good thing? Well, you hate to have to constantly rearrange your books if you're a librarian because they kept reorganizing the Dewey Decimal System or the Library of Congress system. On the other hand, that often means that if you think about what does chemistry mean, what does computer science mean, some of these terms have changed a lot in what they mean. So the bins that you have may not change in terms of what numbers go to those bins, but the meaning of the bins may change. And so maybe things would have fit better someplace else now, but they're already someplace in the bins. They might fit in a more refined category, but we can't do that. We can't move the book to a different category. And finally, we have the question, do we classify broadly or classify precisely? That is, do we have a place for every single possible instance, or do we have essentially bins that will have more than one item at the bottom of the trees? We could have a completely enumerative class race where everything gets a separate number, completely unique, and we could say, well, here's the bin where things go, the bottom of the class. So, we talked a lot about some of these principles when we talked about Weinberger and Svenonius, because Weinberger has some pretty strong notions about whether things like hierarchy and uniqueness are good things. In fact, he says that they're terrible things. He says that these are basically, remnants of a previous time where we were fixated on physical stuff. Right? Things have to be in some particular arrangement and only in one place, and that's because we're used to deal with stuff, and now we don't have to deal with those limitations. We can put things more than one place, and we can do much different kind of relationships. Weinberger puts a lot of energy attacking those, but I think we could argue that hierarchy and uniqueness are pretty deeply ingrained principles how we think about the world. We have a lot of hierarchy built into our way of looking at the world because of our biology. We have parents and we have children and things like that. The idea that a category like a family could be divided into smaller subdivisions, or could divide it into things on the basis of features or sort of characters of the division, those are pretty easy to understand principles. And you ask yourself, well, does uniqueness and hierarchy, are they separate principles or are they really the same principle in different guises? Because is uniqueness required by hierarchy? If you have things in a hierarchical order, will you subdivide and put things in cat classes? No, because then you can make multiple copies of things, right? So again, we tend to think in the physical world that would be very wasteful, perhaps, to have the same book appear in many different places in the library, but you can still have a very hierarchical system and have the same book with a different set of numbers in different places. But they would require lots of rules for that sort of thing. And again, part of the problem we have is that we want to have a system which is principled, but which is doable, usable. So if you have too many rules about where to put things and how to classify things, then no person could possibly follow all the rules. As it is, there's this enormous number of rules of classification, and that's why you go to library school to learn how to put things in places. Okay? So, there's a kind of belief in the one and only one place rule that is embedded in library science, partly because that's clearly the linchpin of a lot of this making this thing doable. Again, you can make it, you can see the benefit of multiple places, but then you have to know about how many places, how do you know that which places you should go, and then when do you stop, and things like that, and it could be very, very tricky. So, if we look in sort of the guidance in this area, like the introduction to the Dewey Decimal Classification, which we'll talk about in a minute, it gives us some guidance about how to know where to put things when you only have one place to put them. And the most important rule that Dewey Decimal tells you is to not to rely only on the title of something. To actually look at the thing, look at the content of the thing. The metadata is one bit of information, but the thing itself is way more important than the metadata when you decide how to classify something. Because the title is often only a clue, and the title is sometimes, you know, not intended to be completely precise about the title. Again, Leaves of Grass is a metaphorical, poetic kind of title from Walt Whitman's collection of poetry. It's not really about leaves, it's not really about grass. Who Moved My Cheese, a book that some of you may know of, is a book about changing jobs and coping with change, not really about the cooking arts. Okay, and if you like these kind of funny examples, you really enjoy Jeff Nunberg's article I pointed to earlier this week about the metadata train wreck in Google, because there's a number of really incredible examples in the Google Book Collection where things have been classified on the basis of very superficial analysis, apparently, of the titles in the works. The other important rule that Dewey Decimal Classification System gives us is this idea that you should put a work in the discipline that where it is going to be used, rather than the discipline from which it derives. That kind of means that you should not be focused so much on the author's credentials or the author's point of view as on the thing that they're writing about. So, for example, if a work by a zoologist on agricultural pest control should be in agriculture, not zoology, because that way all the books on pest control from different points of view will be in the same place. And that will be useful if you want to do something about pests in your garden. Okay. So again, Dewey Decimal System is very pragmatic about how to encourage the appropriate things to be found at the point of use. Related to that is the notion that says works dealing with multiple subjects should be classed with the subject being acted upon. You'd put a book on Shakespeare's influence on Keats with Keats. Okay. Work on influence of the Great Depression on 20th century art would be in art, not in the Depression. Okay, again, it's like the topic that is the subject being acted upon is where you put them. Again, I want to make this point about rules because I want to make you realize that this is a very, very difficult subject, and there's literally books and books and courses you can take about how to make sure you name things right, classify things right. It's easy when you're in the library school ghost town, as I've often characterized it, because library school is gone, but it used to be in this building, that stuff is no longer relevant. In fact, the intellectual foundations of library science and what this course is all about. That's why it's called Intellectual Foundations of Information Organization. Again, these rules that basically help you figure out how to put things in one place with any hope of the different people who are cataloged finding the same place for it. It's got to be reliably systematic so that two people would end up at the same place having read the same work. Now, there are different classification schemes used by research libraries. The most commonly used one is the Library of Congress classification. This is a starts with letters, and you see A through Z here. You look at this just quickly, and you might have some observations you can make about it. The first thing that might jump out at you is that it's, if you look especially around, say, D and E and F, that is kind of U.S.-centric in its classification scheme. But, of course, it is the library of the U.S. Congress that started this. It reflects kind of the view of knowledge that was in place at the time the Library of Congress started at the beginning of the 19th century. And sure enough, you see that there was a... we were more widely educated then in something. We had a more broad view of knowledge. We had like more Renaissance perspective. We had philosophy, psychology, religion. We had the political science. We had law. We had education. We had the fine arts. Science and technology were each only one bin. Agriculture was its own bin. As was military science and naval science, their own bins. Because, well, why is that? Why in 1800 are these their entire own bins? Anyone have any idea? Well, back in 1800, it's pretty important in the United States of America to know about military and naval science, especially since much of the Library of Congress that was the private collection of Thomas Jefferson that he gave to the Library of Congress to start it. And so he had an interest in certain topics, and this actually reflects some of his view of knowledge. Now, the problem is that when you have this view of the Library of Congress starting point, when you, each subject gets a place, it kind of keeps it. So new disciplines have to find their place in the cracks. And so you can think now, looking at this, which is likely to be kind of the Library of Congress ghetto and which is the Library of Congress ghost town? Are there lots of books under V compared to, say, under T or under Q? I mean, you know, we probably did a lot more new book writing in science and technology than we have done in naval science since 1800. Now, there's been a lot of books in naval science, but I suspect that, relatively speaking, there's been a lot of explosion in the Qs because that's what we've had. We now have a technologically driven economy and scientifically driven economy. And sure enough, if we ask ourselves, well, where would we put something like computer science, which of course didn't exist when the Library of Congress classification was invented? Well, we put it in science, because it was a science. And we made it. Let's see. Here's the Q top level partitions. We have mathematics, astronomy, physics, chemistry, natural history, botany, zoology. Well, gee, where is computer science? Turns out the computer science is QA76, because it was sort of a, you know, spinning out of mathematics. I mean, we've talked a little bit in the iSchool about how things that we talk about, things like the emergence of service science. IBM has been helping to drive the development of service science as a discipline. IBM was very instrumental in developing computer science as a discipline. They actually helped hire some of the first professors in computer science programs by giving their mathematicians from IBM Research University appointments that had, we'll teach those engineers how to do mathematicians, how to do computing programs. We had people that could work for us with our new computing machines. If they wanted to have work for us, they had to kind of jumpstart computer science. But it always has been funny to me to see that, you know, we had to make a QA76. Why didn't we use, we could have used, you know, Q T or QZ or something. We didn't, you know, we didn't, what were we saving them for? We used QA76, but we could have used Q something else. And we squandered the chance to make a QG or something, and I never said that, quite understood that. Maybe they thought it was going to be a strange part of mathematics. That's right, could very well. They didn't think they were going to be, we only needed four computers anyway, but all the world's computing, so we didn't need to have a lot of computer science. That's possibly right. They figured it would have a small place, so let's give it a small hole. Okay. Now, the Library of Congress is probably the most widely used classification system in research libraries and university libraries, but it's not the most widely used classification by any means. That title goes to the Dewey Decimal System, which was started in 1876. This is very widely used in public libraries. And you look at this and you sort of get a very interesting view of the world in which Melville Dewey grew up, because Melville Dewey is the person that made up this library scheme. He was the librarian at Amherst College in Massachusetts. It's funny, Melville Dewey was his name, and you think, Melville, what a strange name that is. What an odd name. Melville was actually a very common name when Melville Dewey was born, because Melville was named the year that Moby Dick came out, which is a very popular book, and it was written by Herman Melville. And so it's like naming your kid Brittany or Alicia or, you know, Jessica today, it named after kind of a popular actress or something like that, because it was a very popular name. Melville Dewey was named after Herman Melville because Melville was a very popular guy because of his book. Now, it turned out that Melville didn't like his name spelled Melville with V-I-L-L-E. He was kind of a spelling evangelist and kind of simplified spelling guy, and he named himself M-E-L-V-I-L after a while. Kind of a, oddball in that respect. But he organized the library collection that Amherst had. Amherst was a somewhat religious school at the time, and so it's not surprising that its collection had a lot of books on philosophy and religion. But of course, it was a book collection that was in a North American, university, and so its view of religion was somewhat different than you might expect if you were to develop a system today. This is a Dewey system view of religion. It has a lot of categories for Christian religious topics. And then there's this kind of thing called 290 where everything else goes. And of course, this bends a lot of people out of shape when they see this. They go, well, what about my religion? You know, Judaism and Buddhism and I'm a Jain or whatever it is, right? It's like, sorry, but Melville Dewey didn't have this book in his library. And he was basically using the principle of literary warrant. I need a system that works with the stuff I got. Not for stuff I might have or imagine to have, but what have I got? I want to make a system work for that. But what this points out is that Dewey wasn't an evil person trying to punish those, make it hard for Buddhists or Jains to find books. He was just trying to do his job for his library collection. And his system made sense from his point of view because it met the books that he had. So the point I want to emphasize is that classifications, as I've said at least 50 times already this semester, every classification system is biased. When we choose categories, we are basically taking a point of view on what we're going to count and treat as the same. And it distinguishes between sort of good ways to do things and bad ways to do things, good ways to count things and bad ways to count things. And so we have lots of interesting examples that you can find. Again, 202 in the News is all about these kind of biased classification schemes or biased use of language. I have a couple I want to show you just to hammer the point home once again. Some of my favorite examples from 202 in the News. Here's one from a couple years ago. Here's a story in the New York Times about someone said, I kind of wondered about why it was that I read that the New York City trains are always on time, but whenever I'm there, they're not there. And it turns out that the New York City transit system decided that on time meant within plus or minus 3 minutes. So that kind of performance would be viewed as hopelessly incompetent in the Paris or Taiwan or London or any subway system in the world practically, but not in New York apparently, where 3 minutes is pretty damn good, so that's on time. Likewise, after lots of complaints about the time it took first responders to get to fires, okay, saying, my God, the fire truck didn't show up for 15 minutes. And these were beginning to be very embarrassing statistics. They decided to change what they counted. The response time to a fire became not the time for the first fire truck, but for the first responder that was an institutional responder. So if a police car pulled up to the fire, that counted as the first response to the fire. So you'll see that will obviously shrink your response time if the first cop can be there 10 minutes ahead of the first fire truck. Now, of course, not going to help get the fire out, but it will increase your on-time performance and response time to fires. Some sports teams are embarrassed by the fact that no one comes to their game to them because their teams are so lame, so they stop reporting their attendance. They started reporting their paid attendance. And if you pay for the seat, you might as well have come because we got the revenue, so we're going to call it paid attendance. So the New York Knicks would play before empty arenas, and they'd say paid attendance 12,000, even though 1,800 people were in the arena because the seats were paid for. And finally, one that you might have suffered from, it's two in New York, it's two in San Francisco, power failure happens, and they go, oh, well, 1,200 customers are without power right now. Well, but customers are not people. Customers are things that get electric bills. All right, now, if that's your family and your house, that might mean three people, four people, two people. It's not orders of magnitude bigger than the number of people who are out of power. But if a customer is an apartment complex with 1,000 units and it's without power, you could have 5,000 people have no power, but that's only one customer outage for the power company. So you can see how that kind of categorization of events could be really helpful to the utility company that's trying to explain how well it's doing, and not so well for the customer who's trying to understand why it is this power is always out, even though they have such great reliability in the system he supposedly lives in. Okay, another interesting classification system is the U.S. Census, which of course has as its purpose the enumeration of people so they can do things like apportion congressional seats, develop services, all kinds of government policies based on the census. But what are we going to count? How we count things is a very important decision, and we keep changing it. So for a long time, the United States Census said, well, are you white? Are you black and free? Or are you black and a slave? And nothing else mattered because white and black were kind of the binary decision-making point about how your life was in the United States at that time. Okay? After we started having a lot of freed blacks, we started counting mulattoes, people who were of mixed blood. We started adding other ethnic groups. For a while, we had a little bit of racial backlash. And so we should kind of know whether you're 1/4 or 1/8 black, namely, are you quadroon or octoroons? Okay? And we have other kind of interesting classification schemes. You say, well, what's the principles of these classifications? Are we defining race biologically or genetically or what? Or how about according to social biases of the time? You know, interesting that Mexicans appeared once in the U.S. Census, and that was in 1930. They had not come back. We have Mexicans now, but they're not races anymore. Because there are now some interesting things about ethnicity versus race going on in the U.S. Census, which is really tricky because, look at this. This is in the last census. If you want to check off what race you might be, and I'm Mexican, I'm Hispanic, I'm going, I'm not sure what to do here, okay? I mean, I used to be a race. And now I'm not a race anymore. Now I'm something else. And I think what I am is I'm now a ethnic group. We now classify people of Spanish culture or origin even as an ethnic group, even if they are regardless of their race. And now we have all these interesting problems with black Hispanics and other kinds of Hispanics that are really making things interesting. And this is 1/8 of the population of the United States, and we now have a completely kind of incoherent category in a lot of ways, causing lots of difficulty. So, I could do this for an hour, but I'm not. I'm going to stop showing you examples of pathological bias classification, but I think you've got the point by now that every system is going to have some bias, and your task is really to decide whether you understand it and whether it's acceptable to you, whether you should invent your own. And one thing that's happened as a result is that people are often starting to do that, invent multiple classification systems. And that's especially true where we don't have a primary hierarchical structure, or you have multiple dimensions or characteristics which determine equivalence classes. So here you see a pretty interesting contrast between two ways of thinking about books and computers. I could have the classification of computers and internet stuff, and one thing I might want to have as a subclassification of that is organization resources about it, and one subclass of that might be books and magazines. Or I could have a shopping view that says I want to buy books and magazines, and one category might be computers and the internet books. Well, which is right? Well, the answer is they're both right. They both have different purposes. I mean, sometimes I want to look at a at a sort of a domain oriented view of information organization. And I may want to have an activity oriented view, and they may have different ways of thinking about the parts. My favorite, not surprisingly to Kate, is wine classification, which is a very nice one because it has a number of independent attributes which are kind of facets of wine. We could say the class of wine, classified by type of grape it is, its body, its flavor, its color, its maker, its price, all kinds of classifications we might use to classify it. But if we tried to build a hierarchy of this, it would be very unwieldy because we could have many, many different levels here. And you'd have thousands of classifications for wines that were different, and that would just not work. So instead of having one classification that has chosen some arbitrary order of these to be the hierarchy, let's choose a system where we have any of them can essentially be used as the primary classifications scheme. And why am I not getting a picture here? I'm trying to show wine.com. Oh, okay. I'm looking at wine.com and it's not happening here. Maybe it's because I have to go back to Air Bears and sign myself off again or something like that. No, is that it? Wine.com. Sorry about this, folks. Oh, there it is. Okay, there's wine.com. So wine.com is a wine shopping site which organizes these different attributes or facets of wine. And you can choose the order in which you consider them based on your knowledge of wine and your preferences about wine. What is your most important characteristic for you? So for some people, the most important characteristic about a bottle of wine is what it costs. I want to buy a bottle of wine that costs less than $3 a bottle, and that's all I'm going to look at. Other people might say, no, I'm a wine snob, and I only like to drink certain varietals. I particularly like those smoky Russian River Pinot Noirs, and I want to shop on the basis of varietal and region. And so I can do exactly that. I can explore this and choose the region. Let me choose a California wine. A California wine from the Sonoma County, because that's where the Russian River is, and I want to choose a a red wine. I want to choose the red one, which is the Pinot Noir category. I'll pick the Pinot over here, and now I have my Pinot Noirs from the Russian River, but I want to only buy the really good ones, the expensive ones, so I'll pick one of these, which are the $300 bottle of wines. That's more like my price point. I'm going to get some of those. So again, you can look through this in a very different way. If I want to look at a cheap bottle of wine, I might go start over. In this case, go over and say, no, I'm going to start over. And I want to look at wine that was really cheap. In fact, I'm going to get the most highly rated wines that are under $20. And I don't even, I want to have a red wine, I guess, but, you know, I don't really care. I'll have a red wine. This is a $17 bottle of wine, Pinot Noir, not from the Russian River Valley, of course. Okay. So, I mean, what we're seeing here is this notion of faceted classification, where the facets are being used as an alternative to hierarchy to overcome the limitations. So instead of thinking of hierarchies as sort of fixed classifications, I'm going to sort of generate dynamically a hierarchical classification scheme based on my ordering of the characteristic or dimensions or relations or facets of some domain. So you can think of it as I'm going to carve up this big set of items into more manageable categories on the fly, and I do that simply by saying what order I want to look at them in. So instead of having to think about all the possible ways of putting items into the classification scheme and sort of building the classification up front, I can say, let me just have a descriptive vocabulary and use the grammar of that vocabulary that says how the instances can be ordered on those dimensions, and then generate the classifications when I want them. So this lets me basically build a small control vocabulary and use it to generate this rich hierarchical structure that happen to follow these very clear rules that explain how these objects fall into the categories. What I really like about this idea is that something to think of it as, I'm able to think of word sentences that describe things I might not have names for. So I could say, gee, I can say, give me all the less than $40 wines that are Pinot Noirs from the Russian River Valley that have a rating of higher than 90 on the Wine Spectator scale. And I've just created a category right then and there by stringing together a set of facets in a particular order. And that's sort of what we're doing when we use the facet system. And there's a lot of these now on the web for things like finding recipes, where I can say, do I want to have recipes of categories? Like, is it going to be a chef recipe or a easy one? Is it going to be a dietary classification or a cuisine-based or a type of dish or whatever? Likewise, I could have a product finder where I say, I want to find a disk drive of a certain capacity made by a certain vendor, a certain price, or whatever. And I can do those things in different orders based on which of those characteristics is the most important to me in my selection. So, in some sense, we are basically generating a user interface that makes it very natural to browse or search in a structured collection, because I created an iterative interaction style where I'm progressively filtering out only valid values. I'm never going to get like, oh, that set is empty, sorry, because I only get to places that I get to by choosing choices that are presented to me where there are values left. So in some sense, the menu is being dynamically generated where the values I have to choose from are those which will give me results. So if the old way is click, 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 and then finally get to things at the end, and I don't know how many I want to find, in a faceted interface, I basically progressively refine the set and I see exactly how many I have at each point in the selection process. So it's a very nice way to winnow down a collection while I have feedback as I go about the number of items I'm going to find. All right, what kind of facets can we put in a collection? Well, we can have enumerative facets where I have all the possible values on some dimension. I could say I want to have the size of my my shirts be small, medium, large, or extra large, and that's all the values that I sell them in. Sometimes people want to put other in facets for scalability, but if you start with that and you have a lot of things that other at the beginning, like you end up with a lot of others, more others than you want. You can have a Boolean facet, yes and no on some dimension. You can have a hierarchical facet, taxonomic, things like geography of the wine industry. Like if I say I want a Napa Valley wine, I could then subdivide that into, California could be subdivided into Napa Valley and Sonoma Valley, and then could be subdivided into Russian River and so on and so on. It's a way to have more precision because I can have, again, this taxonomic. I can say that there's red wine varietals, and that includes Merlot and Zinfandel and Cab Franc and Cab Sauvignon and so on and so on. I may have spectrum facets, where I have some numerical attributes on the range. Something like price, I could easily have some set of prices. I could have, less than a dollar, between a dollar and $5, more than $5. I could have the disk capacity, I could have dates before this date, after this date, some within some years, and so on. It's often better to model these as mutually exclusive regions so that you're sure you get everything, where you say small, medium, large, and you're forced to choose as opposed to some number, because there might be instances which in fact fall outside the bounds of your original classification that way. Let's see. Let's design one of these. So in the reading I gave you, you talked about how to create one of these things. here's kind of an abstraction of everything I've ever read about facet classification to make it a little bit more general. You have to, first of all, figure out what you're going to classify. Now, that's possible in a small domain, but it's not usually possible to do that in the general case. And in fact, that's one of the challenges because, of course, you only have so many examples to work with, but you're probably going to end up with other examples over time. And so you have to be concerned about whether the facet you choose, given that you have to begin with, will still work when you have a larger set of examples to classify. You do this because you have this problem because, of course, how do you identify the facets? You look at the things you're trying to classify and say, well, what are the properties or the attributes or the dimensions that characterize these examples? And I want to pick the ones that will help me kind of cover the space in a good way. You want to say, what facets will give us kind of good breaks in the collection? Will give us good bundles or give good boundaries? That's... again, an iterative process because you'll be testing your classification scheme of the facets on the facets you have on the example to see if the facets do that job of carving up your examples. And ideally, they'll be mutually exclusive. You don't have the problem that things would go in more than one place. You have to then decide, if I have different values for my facets, what order should I have the values be put in? I've got to decide which facets go together in what order do I let them go together. Maybe that certain orders that I want to impose in the faceted scheme will help me shrink my sets faster. I mean, I want to build every possible order into my facet interface, which will cause me maybe to iterate some and add new facets or relax some of the constraints. And again, it's sort of mother to say you should iterate, but because that's mother and apple pie of design, but you're going to find when you develop your faceted classification scheme that as you will when you develop your vocabulary, that the first instances you choose are going to bias you in some particular way, and you may describe that as you have different instances or even the same instances in different order, you look at the world differently. And so you're going to want to try to encode a number of different instances using your scheme and might even try doing them in different orders. So what are the criteria for choosing facets? I mean, Sinonius talks about this, Danton talks about this, other people talk about this. Here's sort of something I've developed, again, over time, partly by doing assignments with this and trying to figure out what I should have told people to do to get a better job next time. Here are some goals when you try to develop facets. You want to try to make them orthogonal as much as possible, independent dimensions. You kind of want to have what I call balance, where you have the top level facets are ones which are the most important in the domain. They do the best job of kind of carving up the domain. In some domains, like geography is really important, it's less important than other domains. So the domain will give you some hint about how to carve up things. Coverage, can you get all the current instances you have, but can you scale it? Can you like it to anticipate future instances and have them work? You might want to think about this when you get instances to say, well, what might the next one be if I don't know what it is? We'll test that by having an assignment where people give you ones you didn't see before when you develop your system. You see how robust your system was. Again, don't want to use categories which work over the present range versus the possible range. Like, you wouldn't want to have a date facet that said 2008, 2009, because next year it wouldn't work. You want to have, you know, some range, maybe the next 5 years or something like that. You want to have objectivity in a sense where you can imagine, could you be a way to objectively classify this? Maybe could you imagine doing some measurement or some test or some observation which would tell you where to put this thing, where it wouldn't be different, people would put it in different places. And finally, you want to have then be as much as possible, have your facet semantics be mainstream or normative and not be clever. While it's possible you could say, I want to use as one of the facets in my wine classification, the number of letters in the typical spelling of the wine varietal name. You know, Merlot is M-E-R-L-O-T, so that's 6. That's not a very useful way to think about the names of wine grapes. And so while it's objective, it's sort of idiosyncratic and might be cute for you, but Most people go, huh, and not want to do it that way. So again, pick ones that kind of will make sense to an ordinary person who walks up to your classification system, and you'll be better off. Okay. Another important guidance in your facet of design is to maintain kind of intelligent hierarchical organization. Here we are trying to organize sports, and you know, if I have a facet called sports, and I want to the value on it, I want to have it be team sports versus football versus basketball versus solo sports. I'm going to have a hard time classifying things correctly if I have team sports and I've got another category that has other team sports in it. So I want to separate team sports and solo sports as a first class partition. I want to try to, if I can, order my values simple to complex. Like here I'm making, so I can look at this and sort of imagine the object in the world and seeing where it falls. And I have walk, run, jump, skip, hurdle, cartwheel. I have maybe frequent, popular to infrequent, unpopular. Maybe spatial, follow the kind of order of the map, or chronological. Again, other kind of sensible schemes that will make sense to the person trying to use your collection. Alphabetical is a reasonable one for facets. Size, even if it's arbitrary, if it's what everyone uses, you should use it. So here you see eeny, meeny, miny, moe is kind of a canonic ordering. You can imagine a scheme where that's what you would use to count things because it's what you use. So we're going to use this in an assignment, something called Facet Map, which lets us try out these things. It's a website where you basically can build a faceted classification called a facet map, a scheme, and load it as an XML file which configures the operation of the facet map software. And that'll be a lot of fun. And you get to see how the same facet map can be manifested as different user interface representations. Okay, so let's talk historically for just a few minutes about faceted classification. I want to give you some sense of its history because see how it shows up in different kinds of library science places. The idea of faceted classification actually comes from Condorcet, who's a French mathematician and philosopher, who said that he thought he could see that all facts have five points of view. And so we could describe anything in terms of five relationships. So he said there are five points of view, and there's so he had 10 categories, of 10, five categories of 10 terms each, so he had 100,000 categorizations of things. Raghunathan, who's a Hindu mathematician, brought this idea to information science in the early 20th century. And he was a kind of mathematician who was a philosopher librarian of sorts. And he sort of said, it's my role in life, my purpose in life is to organize the universe. And with a single set of classifications. And he came up with this idea that there were five kinds of universal facets that could be described, anything could be described using these facets. And in his books he has just incredible detail how you describe complex things using these five facets of the universe of knowledge, these five atomic concepts. And those five atomic concepts are, and again, it sounds a little mystical to us today, are personality, matter, energy, space, and time. He says, anything in the world can be described in these, using these five dimensions. It has a kind of tightness or personality. It has a kind of material in which it might be made of. It does something. It has some kind of energy that causes it to act or move or carry out some activity. It has some place where this occurs, and it has some time when it occurs. And so he can define the place for putting a book using these five universal facets. And so he'll say that a book on the management of banks in India up to 1950 is X82, 855, and 5, because he has these are the values that come out of the facets. P for the type of thing, economics, its energy is banking, its location in India and so on. He has these code lists that he uses in these ways. And a lot of Indian libraries use this classification scheme. I think it's a little bit, I mean, you read Raghunathan and he has this kind of, you know, I want to make the world work and describe the way the universe is. It's a very kind of, you know, mystical, religious kind of thing. And even this concept of Dharma, he uses the word Dharma. I think Dharma means destiny at some sense, right? That it's my purpose for which I'm on the planet to do this thing, to make up a library system, you know? My purpose is to be here in this classroom talking to you. His purpose is to make up a library classification scheme. Now again, this is not used very much anymore because people sort of said, you know, we like the idea of a faceted scheme, but it's kind of hard to imagine everything in the world has the same five facets. So let's take the idea of facet, but not to be so rigid about it, and have a larger vocabulary that we can use as the values of the facets. So we basically push the kind of semantics down one level. Instead of saying that the top level faceted scheme is about personality, matter, energy, space, and time, we kind of said, no, there's like headings and subheadings, and then we use categories within those levels that are sort of more syntactic. So you see in the Library of Congress a faceted scheme that says, let's use topic, place, time, and form, but let's have a little bit more arbitrariness in our ordering and have a lot more variety of the vocabulary from which they come. So we can say things like, here you see a book that has topic, main heading, followed by place, topic, time, form. So it's art criticism followed by Paris, France, Paris, history of the 19th century, as a bibliographic type thing. Versus another one which has these things in sort of different semantic order because it's a different kind of book. So we've eliminated the Raghunathan universality, but we have a much more flexible system, which is what we ended up using now for most of the world's libraries, at least the research libraries. And with that, I think we're done with Lecture 8. Lecture 9, which we're going to get to sometime in the 28th of September, which seems like just a couple days for you and it's a long way for you for me. We're going to talk about ontology, because ontology is the next level down, or the next level of more formality in describing about what meaning is and how we can communicate our meanings to other people and other systems. With that, good luck with the reading, and I'll see you on the 28th of September.